Hi, podcasters. Ira Flatow here with a request. You know from listening to the show that we deal in facts and realities. And one of those realities is that it takes many hundreds of thousands of dollars to make Science Friday and these free podcasts that hopefully you enjoy. The other reality is that we at Science Friday have to raise a great majority of that money ourselves. Yes, we get some from your donations to your public radio station, so please keep doing that. But that only covers a fraction of our costs. And sure, we get some money from the underwriting announcements here, but hardly enough to cover our expenses. Hundreds of thousands of you download these podcasts each week, each month. You have the power to keep us going. If every one of you gave us just a dollar, we could ensure the future of these broadcasts and these podcasts. We need your help. Please go to our website at sciencefriday.com and click on the donate button there. Give us $1, $5, whatever you think it's worth to you to keep Science Friday part of your week. Please donate what you can at sciencefriday.com. And thanks. And now, on to the program.
Have you heard this one? Two scientists walk into a bar. Maybe they should have ducked. You find that funny? Do science and funny go together? This hour will put that to the test. And our hypothesis, science can be funny. Scientists can be successful comedians. And using a little humor might help scientists communicate better. The proof? We've run down the best and the worst science jokes. It's our first annual April Fool's Science Comedy Show. So take my lab notebook, please.
Oh, that's a tough crowd.
Can science be funny? Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, so step up to the mic and tell us your great one-liners. Two scientists walk into a bar after this break.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. It's historic because today is our first annual April Fool's Science Comedy Geekathon, trying to answer that age-old question, can scientists, mathematicians, geeks be funny? Not just to themselves, but to everyone else. We've gathered a panel of science comedians on our own Flora Lichtman to test the hypothesis, can science be funny? We're going to see if we can prove that's true. Science and comedy do go together, and you don't need a bow tie and a propeller hat or a bubbling flask to make people laugh. Well, I guess those props always do help, Flora. If this proves not to be the case, then you can all consider this show part of our April Fool's joke. And during the week, we asked for your help, too, on our Facebook page. And boy, did you respond. We asked you to tell us your favorite jokes, science jokes, good ones, the worst ones. And hundreds of you contributed your favorite jokes, and we'll be sharing some of them this hour. Some of you may not want to quit your day job, though, so...
Ouch.
Ouch. And if you still have a joke you want to share with us, you can still add that joke to our list and go to our Facebook at Facebook.com/SciFry and join in. Or you can go to our website, sciencefriday.com, and add to our joke list. Click on the two scientists walk into a bar link. And we thought that would be the best way to call our jokes. And also you can send us a tweet. You can tweet us a joke. Can you make a joke 140 characters? We'll find out today, even a science joke. Our number for your joke, if you want to call in a joke, is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And as I say, you can tweet us, and that's at SciFry, at SCIFRI. And as I say, we don't want to have to push the dump button on your jokes today, so please keep them clean, if you know what we're talking about. And a little discretion, as advised, is not Comedy Central this afternoon, but hopefully you get close to it. Let me introduce my guest. Brian Mallow is a science comedian and a freelance science video correspondent for Time Magazine. He joins us from KQED in San Francisco. Welcome to Science Friday, Brian.
Great to be here, Ira. You really set us up for this. I like the way you stacked the whole first part of the show with as much tragedy as possible. Cancer, radiation, global warming. Now send in the clowns.
There you go.
Very nice.
Tim Lee is a former scientist and now a science comedian. He joins us from NPR West in Culver City, California. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
You're welcome. Norm Goldblatt is a physicist and a science comedian. He joins us by phone. Hi, Norm.
How you doing? Good to be here.
Thank you. And Flora Lichtman is here. She, of course, is our multimedia editor, and we brought Flora in because she's got a great sense of humor, and we'll help judge.
Yeah, that's right. I'm not a science comedian.
No. But,
but I do have control of sounds like this today. I'm your tough crowd.
You're in control.
She is in control. I want to begin this is because we asked everybody on Facebook and Twitter to send in their jokes. And a lot of the jokes had a similar theme. A lot of people, one of those themes was the great jokes also were the worst jokes, people thought. Yeah. And there was one recurring theme having to do with atoms and charges. Let me read that joke. And I'll take Tara Kresge Summerfield's version of it. And she says, so two atoms are walking down the street. One stops and exclaims, I think I lost an electron. The other replies, really? Are you sure? The first replies, yes, I'm positive. Go. Yeah. Brian, is that a common sort of joke?
Oh, that is the most common. The other one that is paired up with it, that these two jokes show up in every thread on the internet ever that has to do with science humor. The other one is the neutron walks into the bar and asks for how much for a beer, and the bartender says, for you, no charge. And those have got to be the two oldest, most oft-told science bits.
There was one that came into the neutrino walked into a bar, and the bartender said, sit down and stay, make yourself at home. He said, no, I'm just passing through.
Well, now, that one, I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but I actually came up with that one.
Did you?
I was doing a show. I was asked to do a show at the Koshland Science Museum in D.C. about infectious disease once.
Right.
I'll show you the connection between neutrinos and infectious disease eventually. But because of that, in trying to come up with material about infectious disease, I decided to write some bar jokes like those that we're talking about. So I did a couple about infectious disease and viruses, and they were so popular in my act that I wrote more of them. And it's my most popular video on YouTube. And I've seen them. They're all over the internet now, unattributed. And the neutrino one, yeah, it's one of my
favorites. Let's play. We actually have a little bit
We have a clip of some of your work.
Oh, a virus walks into a bar. The bartender says, we don't serve viruses in this bar. The virus replaces the bartender and says, now we do. An infectious disease walks into a bar. The bartender says, we don't serve infectious diseases in this bar. The infectious disease says, well, you're not a very good host. That's okay. Groaning is acceptable.
Do you get a lot of groans?
Well, when you're telling puns, of course. And you know, the risk, you know, everyone would like a video to be very popular. But the risk is, like, I'm best known by this series of bar jokes, and it doesn't necessarily represent everything I do. But hey, I love wordplay. I love puns, so I'm okay with it, and groaning is okay.
Well, Tim Lee, don't you have to, with these jokes, they're sort of all inside jokes. Don't you have to assume that your audience is intelligent enough to know what a neutrino or a neutron is?
Yeah, there's really no point in telling science jokes to people who aren't interested in science, although people do it all the time. I think, yeah, you just kind of have to assume that the audience is interested enough in what you have to say that they came there of free will and they're going to have a background to understand it. So sometimes what I like to do is explain a premise and then go into the joke from there. Mm-hmm. And that works really well for people who don't have as strong a science background. I do a parody of a college science seminar, so I can set it up with an explanation of a topic and then make a joke about the topic. That works well for me.
Do you have a favorite joke you want to share with us?
A favorite joke of my own?
Well, the one that you tell when, you know, you're warming up the crowd and you're giving your PowerPoint presentation.
Well, I can't do the PowerPoint stuff here, but I can tell you a favorite lab joke of mine.
Okay, go ahead.
Did you hear about the biologist who was the life of the party? He had to throw out his results. Apparently he had no control. There we go. As you tell the biologists around the lab.
Norm, you want to jump in here?
Sure. No, it's very interesting. I was listening to all of the jokes and thinking, well, the first thing that came to my mind is what, and Tim alluded to this, what is the background of the listener? And even the I'm positive, you know, assumes you know that positive and negative are different, and that electrons are negative charges, and I don't know whether we can assume that. So, you know, the most innocent science joke has to be analyzed, at least I do, in order to present to what I would call a lay audience. Mm-hmm. I try to make my jokes with the assumption that the audience is at the very least intelligent. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Not necessarily that they have a science background. And if an intelligent person who doesn't have a science background doesn't get the joke, I take it pretty seriously and I back up and add a little bit of preface to it to give them a context or something, or make the joke in such a structure the joke in such a way that, yeah, even though they didn't know what I was talking about at the end, they'll leave knowing something new.
Yeah, there are some jokes that you can tell, and I'll take one from our Facebook page. This is Alan Holyoke wrote, "Did you hear about the new restaurant on the moon? Great food, but no atmosphere."
Now,
That is the third most common. That's a classic.
It's a wordplay, and again, the assumption is people know there's no atmosphere on the moon. I mean, it is quite interesting, though. When you're talking about astronomy as an example, how few people even look up at the moon, much less know that there's no atmosphere or what an atmosphere is. And there probably is some atmosphere, you know what I'm saying? There are all sorts of levels of understanding of these things.
But this seems like the big challenge with science jokes, because they're almost always, seems to me, based on some kind of jargon. And actually, we have a listener who called in with a joke, which is also a wordplay.
Mm-hmm. Hi, this is Bruce from Kreskeville, PA. I have a joke. It's my favorite chemist joke, and that is, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the precipitate.
Yeah. I give that
a clown horn.
Well, now see, my expertise is physics, so this is a chemistry joke, and I had to stop and think about what a precipitate was. I mean, the fun was that I knew that the two words were connected together, and that's what the fun was. And then I had to say, well, what is a precipitate, really?
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a joke for you physicists, then.
Oh, good.
Craig, this was my favorite one, pulled off the... a Facebook page from Craig Nauer, who wrote, "Heisenberg gets pulled over speeding. The cop mm-hmm. says, 'Do you know how fast you were going?' And Heisenberg responds, 'No, but I know exactly where I am.'"
I thought I wrote that.
Yeah. That's pretty nerdy.
Which is another thing, is there's no such thing as an original joke.
That's Benjique, as we would say.
That's extreme, first of all, that one is very, very
arcane when you break it down, right? Yeah. How many people know the essence of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, and that it has something, I mean, everyone knows it has something to do with not being able to know anything exactly, but the fact that you're pairing up velocity and position, location. You know, this is graduate level physics.
How long ago could you tell? I mean, could you tell science jokes? How many years going back? Was it the pre-war? Could you tell science jokes? People know that thing?
Tom Lehrer's been doing it since the 50s, right?
Right.
Yes, he has. He's going back, and I'm sure he's not the first person, but he has some great, you know, the Element song, which mm-hmm. is now a classic. I mean, every lab around the country, they play that every now and again.
But Tom Lehrer?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. He probably is the first science guy. That's great, yeah.
But we had a group called They Might Be Giants here, and they didn't even know that.
Uh-huh.
They have a show, they have an Elements song. They didn't know that Tom Lehrer actually had created one years ago.
Oh, wow.
So there's a generation gap in science.
Right, and
theirs isn't as funny, but it's great.
The old Equalizer, go to the internet, and you'll probably find lots of Elements songs or, you know, mnemonics for remembering the periodic chart, which turn out to be melodic.
All right, speaking of melodic, I have to break in and take us to our first break. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. You can also tweet us your joke at SciFry. Some people are going to try to come in with jokes that you can be 140 characters, or you can send us your joke at sciencefriday.com, where we're archiving all of them there. And two scientists walk into a bar. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. If Science Friday is music to your ears, hey, you ought to try us in Technicolor. We make videos too. Subscribe to our free video podcast on iTunes or watch them through our website at sciencefriday.com. I'm sure you'll enjoy them. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. It's our April Fool's special on Science Friday. We're talking about Can Scientists Be Funny? With Brian Mallow, who's the science comedian and freelance science video correspondent for Time magazine. Tim Lee, a former scientist and now a science comedian. And Norm Goldblatt, who is still a physicist and a science comedian. And I asked before the break, can you actually tweet a short joke? And one came in, and somebody may recognize it. And the tweet says, Schrodinger's cat walks into a bar.
Hi.
And he doesn't.
Yes.
Boy, talk about, you know, talk about obscure.
Thing. Yeah.
Yeah. You can hear that on my on that same video clip if you let it run a little longer.
I knew that one of you would recognize. Let me go to the phones, and we're going to bring on see if we can bring on some folks to tell their own jokes. Hi, Dan. And Dan's in Oklahoma City. Hi, Dan.
Hey, how's it going, Ira?
All right. This is how I want it to work. You tell us your joke, and we'll judge it, and then we'll have our comedians tell their jokes, and you're going to judge it. Okay.
Yeah. Sounds good.
All right, give us your joke first.
All right, it's got a little cheese on it, but I think you'll like it. How does a naturalist catch a squirrel?
I give up.
He climbs up a tree and acts like a nut.
No, I'm just kidding. I liked it.
It's a diss on naturalists.
Dan, where did you find that joke?
Actually, I made it up when you guys said you were going to be doing
lunch
jokes.
That gets bonus points.
You don't happen to be a scientist, Dan, do you?
I describe myself as a fungineer.
A fungineer?
Oh. Yeah.
You deal with fungi?
No. not very often. Maybe some morels. But I work at a hackerspace here in Oklahoma City.
So you're a geek.
Yes, absolutely.
And so a geek can come up with a funny joke that's funny to everybody.
Yes.
All right. Now we're going to put you to – you be one of our judges. We're going to ask each one of our guests. I'll start with Norm Rosenblatt to give us one of his jokes.
Oh, one of my jokes. I was prepared to comment on the other joke.
All right.
In any case.
Go ahead.
One of the ones I enjoy most is the story about Galileo – who, as you remember, dropped things from the Leaning Tower of Pisa. And as a geek kid, we did the same experiment. And this is what we found. If you take two objects, one heavy, one light, it doesn't matter, and drop them from the same place, the same height, at the same time, they will hit the same person.
All right, that was Norm Goldblatt's joke. Tim?
All right, here's another lab joke for you. Millipede goes up to a centipede and says, hey, you want to join our club? Centipede says, no, you guys have too many members.
Hey, that's good.
Brian Mallow, can you top this for playing?
I don't know about topping anything, but in terms of short jokes and tweetable sort of jokes, I have a bit about how science, most science on television, is so watered down, it's homeopathic.
Oh.
You just got 1,000 yoga haters out there now.
Yeah. That goes over really well at the skeptics.
Dan, in Oklahoma City, which one would you like the best there?
Well, I like the too many members joke.
Yeah.
All right. I'll put that one in my act now. I wrote that just for today's show.
All right, there you go. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.
Wish we had a prize for you.
A trophy.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. We've got another joke on the line here that came in on the phone. Let's listen to that joke.
This is one of our favorites.
Hi, this is Lori from Gladstone, Michigan, and here's my science joke. Why did the fungus marry the alga? He took a liking to her.
Yeah. We love liking it, Science Friday, so that's part of that. We're biased.
We found there were very many variations on that, right?
People love the lichen jokes, yeah.
There's also the, why did the lichen marry the fungus? Because he was a fungi.
Or how did the marriage end up on the rocks?
Oh,
I'm going to give myself
a drum. Are you sure this is still going to be an annual event?
Not when we get through with it.
I want to hear all the groans going on across the country right now.
Here's a tweet. They're getting these short tweets in. What type of bear dissolves in water?
Ooh, what type of bear dissolves?
A polar
bear.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Mallow for the win.
You got to back engineer the joke.
Is that how you write a joke? Do you write the punchline first and then back
sometimes
into it?
Yeah. It can happen that way.
Yeah.
Not necessarily always. Sometimes you do say, come up with kind of a funny punchline and go, you see, in terms of, like in that case, you could have looked at it. Let's say you needed chemistry humor and you looked at a list of glossary terms. So many words, like solution for precipitate. Mm-hmm. So many words have pun potential that's one way to come at it. Other times you're in the setup. You're saying the setup quite naturally and then the punchline just pops out of it.
Guys, do you think that this occurs to me as maybe we're just in the genre of corny dad jokes?
Yeah.
I mean, can science jokes go beyond the corny dad
jokes?
Yes, yes, they can.
Well,
they
give
can.
Me an example.
But dad jokes are wordplay. It's hard to do it on air because, you know, generally they have more
true
dimension
enough,
to them.
Everything we do is, it's out of, out of context. You know, when people, that is always a thing that comedians in general face. You're on an airplane, the person next to you finds out you're a comedian and they want you to tell a joke.
Right.
Well,
it's
when we're
torture.
On stage, we're not always that jokey. And if you want it, so to give you something out of context, it has to be, well, I used to be an astronomer, but I got stuck on the day shift.
Yeah.
You know, it has to be jokey like that. But if we're on stage, we might be more conversational and take our time. And
plus, there can be physicality. You can have visuals.
It's a lot of pressure.
Let's go to JR in Circleville, Ohio. Hi, JR.
Hello, Ira. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. I don't really have a joke for you guys. I just thought I'd tell you a story. A few years ago, I'm a high school teacher, and a few years ago, a test question on the Ohio graduation test basically was one of your guys' jokes.
Ooh.
They made a little comic strip of two atoms talking to each other. One atom says to the other, I lost an electron. The other one says, how do you know? Or he goes, are you sure? And then the other electron returns, I'm positive. And
yeah,
then
I think that's a really old joke.
The point of the question was that the students then had to explain what that meant.
Right, there you go.
Wow. And so that was the basis of one of the questions on the Ohio graduation test, I'm guessing 3, 4, 5 years ago.
See, jokes do have us to have a lifetime and usefulness.
Right, and the explanation of that joke could be a whole textbook in itself.
Yeah. You know, because of the environment, we're only using recycled jokes.
I think we should tell kids to just use this for Halloween. This is like a treasure trove for trick or treat, because they're all these kind of one-liner.
What do you call a beaker with a college degree?
A beaker with a college degree. Graduated?
A graduated cylinder.
Oh. Yeah.
Normal blast.
See?
In the era of light bulb jokes, remember light bulb? Were there a lot
there,
of
how
science?
Many does, yeah.
How many? Give me a science light bulb joke.
Ooh, a science light bulb.
Well, I have one line, but I don't feel it's not very jokey, but it's that Edison, he didn't invent the incandescent light bulb, but he perfected it. The light bulb was such a good idea, it actually became the symbol for having an idea, which is just an impressive thought. I mean, what was the best thought you ever had? What was your best idea, and does it appear in thought bubbles in cartoons? There you go, yes. That's why I prefaced it by saying not necessarily a punchy joke, but an interesting thought.
I don't know. You may be proving our point about science being funny.
Yeah, it is. It can be obscure, too.
Well, there is a light bulb. We have actually a light bulb joke from, I'll try to get her name right, Henri Delic informed Looney. Maybe that's not a real name. How many scientists does it take to change a light bulb? The current theory is one, but new theories are being put forward all the time, and with experimentation, the old theory may be discredited. So that went too high.
You lost me about halfway.
I know. I lost myself. I couldn't read that.
Wait, I have one, Ira, from our Facebook page that just came in. Michelle Tarek writes, a noble gas walks into a bar. It's another bar joke. The bartender says, we can't serve you here. The noble gas does not react.
Yeah, you'll find that in that very same video
that
clip.
Seems I like
Brian's
but
jokes.
But you need to know what a noble gas is.
Yeah, that's very true.
1-800.
But all of us,
Go ahead.
I was going to say that all of us do have, I guess, two kinds of jokes where we play to general audiences success. I don't know if you realize this. Not all comedians know each other, but you're three science comedians here. We all know each other.
We're old
a tight-knit community. And we've done shows together, and we all have stuff that caters towards that special knowledge that some groups have. And we are also capable of performing to general audiences where we either have a kind of joke that kind of works for everyone, or like Tim was explaining, we just make sure that the setup, that's just good communication. You just make sure that you've expressed enough in the setup that the joke will work no matter what.
Can you name any funny scientists?
Oh, yeah.
Name
Neil deGrasse Tyson, yeah. Isaac Asimov, Lawrence Krauss, Richard Feynman.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Well, three of those people are dead.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah, but you know,
I don't know if there's a connection.
They're not funny anymore, but they were at one point.
They all had very active right and left brains, both.
Yeah.
And I think that's really what's
Asimov was a big influence on me. He wrote not only science fiction, but he wrote even more nonfiction, and he wrote with a lot of personality and humor. And he was a big influence on me growing up. I learned a lot of my science from him.
Right, let's go to Ben in San Antonio. Hi, Ben.
How do you do?
This
is a joke I heard from my father over 50 years ago. And the question is, what was the greatest biological experiment of all time?
Give up.
And the answer is, it was when Luther Burbank crossed the Rocky Mountains with his wife.
I don't get it.
I love that.
You don't get it.
I don't get it. I'm going to
Cross being
cross like
breed.
Breeding. Now, cross the...
Wow.
Them.
Okay.
You can't dislike
Thank
it if you don't get it.
Ben, thanks. It's a 50-year-old joke. We just revived it, I think. Thanks, Ben. Yeah, well, Luther Burbank. There must have been an era of Luther Burbank jokes. Are there any Einstein jokes?
Oh, man. There have got to be.
We have a caller coming in. Michael in San Antonio again. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Ira.
Hi there. Do you have an Einstein joke?
It's not a joke. It's a story. I was the chief of campus police at Caltech University for 25 years, and my father was a professor at Caltech when Albert Einstein was in residence there. And the story goes that the only time they ever saw that man crack up at any time was when somebody very audibly passed gas in his classroom. And they said he just went into a stupor. He had to excuse himself and walked out into the hall because he was laughing so hard.
Oh, and he did that every time.
That's what you call laughing gas, I guess.
I can tell you from my experience that in the 25 years that I was at Caltech, the combined sense of humor on a scale of 1 to 10 of all the professors that were there during that 25 years was about a 0.01.
I find that hard.
Even when Richard Feynman was there?
Feynman.
Yeah. I got to take exception to that. And I'm not a scientist, but your other two guests here are. And in my experience, that stereotype of scientist, not fair. You know, scientists, more than anyone, I would say, they've devoted their lives and careers to studying, to being so passionate and studying, just pursuing curiosity and like, why does that bug do that? And they've maintained their childlike wonder with the world. And I mean, why don't we ask, could you even have a show? Of course, this is Science Friday, but could you even possibly have a show asking whether lawyers or accountants can be funny or truck drivers? Like, why scientists? I think scientists are actually very creative, inventive thinkers. There.
Yeah,
nothing funny, but I'm standing up for the scientists.
Thank you, Ryan.
Let me just remind everybody that this is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. Go ahead. Yeah.
The other thing about science is the pursuit of the truth. And the basis of all humor is the truth. And you'll hear that over and over again, that truth plus absurdity is equal to comedy. So in science, you have the truth. If you can add the absurdity to it, you'll get to the comedy.
Right. And that's why Democrats are funnier than Republicans.
All right, let's see if we can. We have one more call that came in on our phone, and let's see if we can listen to that that call now. Florence.
Yeah, it needs a little setup. So Christy from Laramie, Wyoming, told this joke, and it's about three statisticians that go deer hunting.
The first statistician crouches, aims, and fires, but his shot goes off to the right. The second statistician steps up to take her shot, but it veers off to the left. Seeing this, the third statistician jumps up and cheers, "We got him."
We gave that a huge laugh.
Yeah.
I've got a statistician bar joke.
There was one joke on about statisticians that came on our site that's talked about them being mean, meaning the mean, playing off on the word mean.
Yeah, I have that joke.
Go ahead.
The statistician walks into just your average bar. The bartender says, "We don't serve statisticians in this bar." The statistician says, "Well, you're just mean." Yeah. Oh. Now, see, here's a good comedy lesson. You gave away the punchline before I told you the joke.
I did.
Yeah, yeah.
But you still told it very well.
Oh, I mean, yeah. Thank you.
You still recovered
from professional.
That. let me see if I can get a... Don't try this at home. With Ian in Rochester, Minnesota. Hi, Ian.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
So it's more of a pickup line. So if I were a DNA, I'd be DNA Heliocase so I could unzip your jeans.
I'm going to give it two.
Can you explain that, Ian?
The DNA Heliocase unzips the G-E-N-E-S.
Oh, that's great.
Jeans.
That's good.
That's jeans to the children that can't spell
that. That's a good one to use on Friday night at the bar.
Have you used that line yet, Ian?
Not yet.
I think that would work very well with anyone with an advanced degree in molecular biology. So.
I'd like to use that and tell us what happens. Thanks for calling. Right. Thanks, Ian. Even kids are coming up with the pickup lines. Are there any science pickup lines? Any jokes you can think of? Or, you know?
That was the only one I've ever heard.
I used to.
Don't forget, we're a public radio show.
I used to whisper sweet nothings into my girlfriend's ear. 10^-8, 10^-9.
Well, we did. We had some really obscure ones.
Yes.
Right, let's see if we can find the most obscure one.
Oh, great.
I mean, what was that? Did you find that one, Flora? I'm trying to remember what that was. I can't find it.
I can give you an obscure one.
Go ahead. Give us a very obscure one.
Yeah, I've got it. Yeah.
Okay. A guy walks into a statistician's kitchen and finds 2 metric rulers in the oven. He asks him, "Is that normal?" It's like, "Of course. It's a parametrics."
No, I've got nothing.
I was doing an event for the American Chemical Society, and they asked me if I could be off the cuff. And I said, "Yeah, I'm so spontaneous, I have a negative delta G."
Wow, that's obscure.
Now that is only for chemists, because the delta G is a term, it's a measurement of the spontaneity of a reaction. And in that case, what spontaneity means is whether or not you have to, how easily a reaction occurs, do you have to add energy to make it happen?
All right, we're going to look for this joke that we're looking for, this very obscure one. I know it has to do with logarithms, so stay with us. Hey, can't get more obscure than that. Stay with us, we'll be right back talking about science and our science joke hour. Stay with us. I'll be right back. Science is now sexy. Science has become the theme of TV shows and Broadway plays, film and artwork. And we think it's a real trend, and we've created a whole science and arts section right on our website, entertaining interviews with artists and actors, scientists and celebrities. It's the only one of its kind, and I invite you to check it out at sciencefriday.com/arts. You're listening to Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about whether science and scientists can be funny. My guests are stand-up comedians Brian Mallow, Tim Lee, Norm Goldblatt. Also with us is Flora Lichtman, Science Friday's multimedia editor. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Plumbing the depths now for the most obscure. We have found the most obscure. You really have to understand this one.
I'm not even sure I'm going to read it right.
Give it a shot. All right.
Brian Kelly writes, "What's the integral of 1/cabin d cabin?
Yes.
Right.
Log cabin.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, that's a good one. That's a good one.
Yeah. That was a good one, but you really have to understand a whole lot going on.
Well, just calculus. It's a calculus joke. I mean, it requires a vast amount of understanding.
No, you don't have to know any biology for it.
Yeah.
Right, that's right. You don't need any allied sciences, just mathematics.
Yeah.
Probably high school mathematics at that.
You're making me feel bad.
On our math theme, let's go to Steve in Portland, Oregon. Hi, Steve. You got a math joke for us?
I got a math joke here.
Go ahead.
A mathematician is smoking while he's working at his desk and casually sets his cigarette on the edge of his ashtray. It falls off the edge of the ashtray and sets fire to the papers on his desk. He runs over to the fire extinguisher hanging on the wall near the door, grabs it, and puts out the fire. Next day, he's again smoking while he's working, and this time he casually tosses the cigarette into the wastebasket next to his desk. Sure enough, it catches fire, and when he finally notices it, he jumps up and pours the flaming contents of the wastebasket onto his desk. And then he goes back to work, because he's already solved that problem.
That's a great joke. Yeah.
Steve, where did you hear that one?
I heard it years ago. I can't remember where I heard it, but, you know, sometimes a joke sticks, and that one did.
Yes.
Well, you know, there's a sort of a quip about that, about getting a cold, right, and just letting it get worse, and so that you finally get pneumonia and they can cure pneumonia. So it's a similar sort of thing.
Hey, do you see...
No, that wasn't a joke. I don't deserve
it. That's just abusive at this point.
Do you have to? Is it good enough to do the Milton Berle and just recycle everybody's old jokes, or do you have to come up with new ones? All that.
Well, we don't do that. At least
we don't do that.
No,
not. You have to come up with new material.
Very poor form.
Do you guys follow people who are not in doing niche science jokes? Are you? And how does the audience react? Are people sort of like, oh, this is not going to be for me?
Are you saying if we surprise an audience by...
Yeah, do people typecast you as, oh, that's the scientist comedian, and think that it's not going to be relevant? Because...
Oh, I see. Well, I mean, we
got too much of a warning.
our goal is to turn them around.
Yeah.
I mean, you're dealt the audience that you're faced with.
And then we're going to decide today whether our audience thinks...
Check our comments.
That science is funny, because we've run out of time. We've had a great time this hour. I want to thank all of you. And tell us where you can be seen as. Where are you guys performing? Brian, are you on exhibit anywhere, so to speak?
Yeah, you can always find me at sciencecomedian.com and at sciencecomedian on YouTube and Twitter. But I'm actually emceeing a STEM education event this evening that's streaming from stemposium.com later this evening, and I'm doing a comedy show in the Bay Area in the South Bay at Rooster Teeth Feathers next month.
Great.
Oh, great.
Tim Lee?
Yeah, I'll be at the Coronado Playhouse May 20th, and then Punchline. Now, you check my schedule. I don't have it memorized right now, but you can check the YouTube comedian right now. YouTubeComedian.com. You can check me out there.
And Norm Goldblatt?
Yeah, I'll be at the Fox Theater in Redwood City April 18th. And some other more closed functions, one called Skepticon, which is occurring in Berkeley, California. And you can check my schedule out at www.normgoldblatt.com.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you all for making this such an enjoyable hour.
Oh, it was wonderful.
And we'll be...
Sorry, one more time.
One last auga.
And keep those cards and letters coming in and the jokes coming in on our website at sciencefriday.com. Where click on the Two Scientists Walked Into a Bar icon, and also on our Facebook page, Sci-Fry Facebook page. We'll be archiving it and letting them all be up there for everybody else to see. Thanks again, folks. Up next, Flora stays with us for our video pick of the week. And what have we got this week, Flora?
Switching gears slightly, we were looking forward to spring, and you know, everybody knows the classic springtime signals of springtime, the robin, the spring peepers, but there are other organisms that herald, that are harbingers of warm weather. So we went and took a tour through the American Museum of Natural History's insect compactor to look at the bugs that are coming out this time of year, although it's snowing here in New York.
Wait. Insect compact, is that like a garbage compactor? They're not squashing all the bugs.
It sounds violent, but actually it's just the file cabinets that get compacted. But we looked at some of the bugs that come out, and you can expect, for example, stink bugs are coming out around this time, May flies in May, obviously June bugs, you know, coming out in June.
Right.
And we also got a sort of special look at the bee collection at the American Museum of Natural History. And in fact, we have with us today... one of the people we interviewed, Dr. Jerry Rosen, who's the curator of the bee collection, and you can pronounce the class correctly, and I'm sure I can't, to talk to us about when bees are coming out. So are bees they out yet?
Oh, yes, they're out. I collected the first wild bee on the 17th of March, right in my home.
But when it's too cold, bees can't fly, right?
That's right. When it's very cold, insects in general have a hard time moving around. They go into a cold stupor. they just are sluggish.
So what are the bees in New York, for example, doing right now?
Well, right now they're doing nothing.
Like the rest of us.
Probably muttering under their breath, like the rest of us.
Where are they when they're not flying around? Where do they hang out?
Well, they hang out, most of the bees now will be hanging out in their nests.
That's outside of the hive?
Well, a hive is a term that we use for honeybees and honeybees only.
Uh-huh.
A hive is nothing but a nest of a honeybee. So there are all kinds of nests in different places. Most nests around here, I think, are in the ground, but there are nests in hollow tubes in old beetle burrows, for example. Mm-hmm. Carpenter bees, for example, are in their wooden holes right now.
Well, if there are no flowers on the trees now, if the bees are coming out, what are they doing? Where are they going?
Well, they're waiting for the flowers to come out, just like we are waiting for the flowers to come out. And a few flowers are out, as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. And then there are flowers that bloom at different times of the year, and there are some very early blooming flowers, and some that you don't recognize. For example, willows. Willows bloom very early in the springtime, and they give forth a lot of pollen and a lot of nectar, and the earliest bees will probably visit willows.
And also the forsythia are also seem to be coming out.
Forsythia is coming out, but I don't think it offers a reward because I never see any bees going to forsythia. They might be attractive to the color, but they're not going to be attractive for the food that the forsythia bloom, you would think, would be offering.
Mm-hmm. How many species of bees are there?
Well, we don't know exactly, but it's in the neighborhood of 19 to 20,000. I think the official count of the number of described species of bees is 19,500. But those are the ones that are described. And then there are a lot of new species that have yet to be discovered. Not so many around here, but even around here there are occasionally found new species. For example, in our laboratory right now, we have two species represented from New York City that have not been described. And when I say described, I mean named and described. When you describe a species, you put a name on it, and that is the official name of that species forevermore.
So you're going to have a Bronx bee or something?
Well, I don't know what it's going to be called.
The Brooklyn Bees. We had.
Might be a Staten Island bee. You never know.
Well, I won't take Manhattan on it.
And you, I mean, you all have one of the amazing things about our trip to the museum was just how many bees you have in your collection. Can you give people a sense of the scale of the collection?
Well, it's one of the largest bee collections in the New World. Maybe not the largest. We pride ourselves on the size of our collection, but actually, if you put all the bee collections that are sprinkled around the country together, we would still be complaining that we don't have enough specimens. So, and we share specimens.
And is it millions? How many are we talking about?
Oh, yeah, we have roughly between 400,000 and 500,000 specimens. Now, these are bees from all over the world, not just the United States and certainly not just New York. But there are, with 19 or 20,000 species in the world, and then we need to understand them, so we need many specimens of every species to understand the variation that one finds there.
In the video that Flora made, it's our video pick of the week up on our website. You show how a live bee goes from being alive to underneath a pin.
Uh-huh.
Describe the process for us. What you do?
Well, when we go out to collect bees, what we use is a rather large insect net, butterfly net, if you wish. Any net will do. And we merely get the bees in the net, and then we transfer them to a killing tube.
And what's in the tube?
Well, it can be various substances. It can be ethyl acetate. It can be cyanide, and insecticide of one sort or another. Mm-hmm. And they die very quickly.
And then you, as we see in the video of Flora you made.
Yeah, you put it right through. But one thing is, that was it. I mean, there was no chemicals. They just sort of keep, right?
Well, one thing to preserve them, then you have to be worried. I mean, one thing to kill them, and then another thing to preserve them. To preserve them is very simple. You simply mount them on a pin and then keep them in a very dry atmosphere, as in the museum. And you do not let museum pests, and a museum pest is maybe a beetle or an ant or something of that sort, get to it, because they will chew on the dead carcass.
But they don't decompose otherwise.
No, well, they do internally. The soft tissue simply dries out, and you're left with the exoskeleton, wow, the outside of the animal, that stays perfectly for a very long period of time.
100 years?
Well, certainly longer than that.
Really?
Well,
wow.
For example, take a look at amber insects. These are insects that are preserved in amber. They are virtually the entire animal, or the external part of the entire animal, that may be 1 million or 2 million years old.
Wow. We're talking about bees this hour with Dr. Jerome Rosen on Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow with Flora Lichtman. Let's go to the phones. We have a phone call from Kyle in Pomona, New Jersey. Hi, Kyle.
Hey, how are you?
Hi there.
I had a question for your caller. I study entomology in New Jersey at the Richard Stockton College of New Jersey, and on the 7th of March, we collected a series of bees from the family Colletidae, what we determined to be Colletes inequalis, to the best of our ability. And at that time, the only abundant flowers were red maple, Acer rubrum, and we couldn't find much information about any bees feeding on red maple. So I was wondering if your guest had any background knowledge on bees that would feed on red maple.
Okay, thanks. Jack the Rosen?
Well, I'm almost certain that you're correct all the way around. It is Colletes equalis. It's a very early flying Colletes that you find in this area. And if you wanted to find out about the food preference of various species of bees, go to the Hymenoptera catalog, the catalog of Hymenoptera north of Mexico, and you'll find good hints about what kinds of bees go to which flowers.
We're always happy to unite scientists and their bees on this hour. So that was it. It's good. You knew that right off the top of your head. Do you know all the bees in the New York City area?
No, by no means.
Well, they say nice things about you.
In the New York City area, let's say in New York State, there are over 400 species of bees. That's a lot of bees.
Wow. I think most people think all bees are the same.
If you go out to Arizona, you'll find that there are probably 700 or 800 species of bees. In the Southwest in general, the bees are far more abundant in terms of species representation than the New York City area.
And how far north, how far south or north, going toward the poles, can they survive in the cold weather?
Well, it's not a matter of surviving. It's whether they're adapted to getting through the rough cold periods and come out in the springtime when the flowers are blooming. They'll go virtually as far north as they can go where there are flowers.
Mm-hmm. Are there places in the world that you are just dying to go to look for bees?
Oh, yes.
Well, maybe somebody's listening. Tell us about where you'd like to go.
Well, I and a chap who works with me would like very much to get to China and study the bees there. And as a matter of fact, we have made some initial endeavors along that line, and maybe it'll come about.
Mm-hmm. Are there tricks to collecting them? I mean, how do you plan a trip like that?
Well, in this case, we will get in touch with specialists in the country who know about us and we know about them, and we talk to them. And, mm-hmm. Can they accommodate us? Can they find permits so that we can collect the insects in their country? And
pack your nets.
In general, scientists are very internationally minded. We go all over.
Do you expect there are a lot of undiscovered bees there?
Almost certainly. I think it's one of the areas where, and even though many of them have been collected by Chinese entomologists, but we don't get a chance to see them, all the more reason to go there. And we want to do more than collect bees. We want to understand how they live. I am particularly interested in the nesting biology of bees.
Any new information about the colony collapse syndrome?
Well, that's a problem that honeybees face.
Right.
And I... One hears explanations all the time. They don't really know what it's all about. My own suspicion is that maybe any number of things that are affecting colonies in different parts of the country and different parts of the world. Mm. We don't think it's a single causative agent.
And it affects different places. It didn't really hurt the New York City area that much, I understand. Is that right?
Not too much. And indeed, in California, where people complained about the almond crop one year, and it was disastrous. Why, the following year, that part of California had a bumper at almond crops. So it's the entomologists, the farmers, they coped with those problems.
Well, Dr. Rosen, thank you very much for talking about bees this hour with us.
It's always a pleasure.
Thank you, Flora, for that video. Video pick of the week up there on Science Friday. Flora Lichtman, take you to the giant bee collection that Dr. Rosen has as curator and professor in invertebrate zoology at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. I'm Ira Flatow, and I want to thank you for listening and for making this podcast possible. And if you like what we do and you can afford to pitch in, I invite you to go to our website at sciencefriday.com and make a donation. Thanks again.